This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The Biden team is aiming to re-engage with the rest of the world, but it's hard to think about the future while Trump fights the transition.
Foreign leaders around the world who have called the president-elect to offer their congratulations seem to be respecting our democratic norms of transition more than the Trump administration.
Also today, Italy faces new pandemic lockdowns.
I think it's rather easy to predict that the lockdown will be far more difficult to enforce now than in the spring.
And in China, a manufactured holiday is hard to ignore for obvious reasons.
If you use a smartphone, it's very hard to escape it because it's just sort of taken over social media.
Shopping like there's no tomorrow. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. We start off today with a story whose outcome could have an impact on asylum seekers across Europe. On Sunday, a dinghy carrying migrants from Turkey capsized off the coast of the Greek island of Samos. Tragically, a child from Afghanistan drowned. But as part of an apparent crackdown by the Greek government on asylum seekers, the boy's father is now facing unusual charges of child endangerment. Now he's facing a possible 6 years in prison. I spoke earlier with the father's lawyer, Dimitri Houlis, from the island of Samos, and he told me more details about the father and his son and what happened.
He was also a refugee, the father. At 9 years old, he left his country in Afghanistan, and he had to live first as a refugee in Iran and then as a refugee in Turkey. He couldn't have the asylum there. He tried for many years. He appealed his cases because he was always afraid of the water, as he told me. He didn't want to do this trip. But finally, he was advised by his lawyer that he has to leave Turkey because he couldn't stay there anymore. They began around 10 o'clock at night in a boat with 25 or 27 more people, we don't know. And at some point near the coast, it's a very difficult place to approach, and with rocks, their boat was sunk, and he lost his child. His child was wearing a life vest, but he couldn't find it in the water. It was 12 at night, and it was pretty windy. He tried again, and he was screaming, and he couldn't find it. And finally, 9:30 in the morning, so 9 hours later, the body of the boy was brought in Samos Harbor and then to the hospital.
It is a tragic story, but not an uncommon one. So technically, as you say, the boy died on Greek soil, so Greece has jurisdiction over this case. What charges is the father actually facing?
So I think they tried to pin all the responsibilities for the death of the boy to this father, and it's actually a crime in Greece if you put your child in danger. But if you go in a motorbike with your child without a helmet, I can understand. But saying that you're endangering a child's life, which led to death for a father that is coming here to seek asylum, it's something that it has never been before heard. It actually makes the chance to ask asylum for any family impossible, because they can press charges to any family that tries to come here in Greece to ask for asylum. Because here in Samos, here in Greece, you have to come here to apply for asylum. And European Union has put these centers in the Greek islands. So they are forced to do this trip in order to ask for asylum. This father, he was for 2 days in prison. He couldn't see his boy. He couldn't find any psychological support. And now he's in quarantine, and still we cannot get him someone to speak with, someone to help him. He has no phone, so his adventure still goes on.
So we know the Greek government is now taking a tough stance on migration. There's evidence it's illegally pushed back migrants at sea and land borders. Do you see these charges against the father as intimidation, kind of deterrence tactics?
Yes, they try to stop people from investigating what is happening in the water. And they try also to send a message that if you come here, your life will be worse than it was before. So, yes, I think it's one more step to intimidating people from coming here to ask for asylum.
You started alluding to this earlier, Dimitris, that one very cruel part of the story that the German magazine Der Spiegel first reported was that the father was taken handcuffed to identify his child. Greek officers had to physically hold him up because he nearly collapsed. And now all the father wants, apparently, is to attend his son's funeral. Will he be able to?
About the first part, yes, it was really tragic because when we went to the hospital with the father, the poor police officers were very tough in saying that, no, we're not going to take his handcuffs off. When they go down to the morgue, I didn't go with them. But when they came back up, the handcuffs were off and they were hugging him. And I think they understood how inhumane they treated him until that point. So now the second part for us, the difficult part for us, is to arrange his funeral in the best we can.
Dimitris Hulis is an attorney representing a refugee father from Afghanistan whose boy drowned in the Mediterranean on their way to seeking asylum in Greece. The father is now facing charges of child endangerment. Dimitris, thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
11/11, Veterans Day here in the U.S., Armistice Day around the world. Commemorations were held in many countries today, but in Saudi Arabia, a ceremony was interrupted in the worst way. Several people were injured in a bomb attack at an event marking the end of World War I. The ceremony was organized by the French embassy and held at a cemetery for non-Muslims in the city of Jeddah. Foreign diplomats and a Saudi security officer were among those wounded. John Alterman directs the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. John, how unusual is an attack like this? And what do we know so far about what happened exactly?
There have been some small attacks on diplomatic facilities in Jeddah for some time. The U.S. consulate there has been attacked. There's a stabbing attack on a guard outside the French consulate a few weeks ago. I think one of the big questions is, how much sophistication does it really take to do this? I've seen the explosive described as either a grenade or an IED. I'm not sure you need a very large organization to do this, and we may be seeing the gasps of a tiny group of radicals, or we could see the beginning of something that's much more concerning.
And for that reason alone, you would expect Saudi security to be on alert during a high-profile ceremony like this. Was that not the case?
I think they are on alert, and certainly there's a lot of security in Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia had a moment where there are a lot of attacks going on after 9/11, and the Saudi security services got extremely serious. There are a lot fewer attacks like this, but there are still remnants of organizations. There are still radical individuals, perhaps radicalized over the internet, perhaps small groups organizing in mosques. I think the Saudi government has been working very hard to stamp this out, but there are still issues.
This attack comes at a time of especially high religious tension. It's boomeranging around after last month's murder of a French school teacher after he displayed a caricature of the Prophet Muhammad from the Charlie Hebdo magazine. How concerning is this violence to you?
We've seen an escalation in tensions between France and Orthodox Muslims. There was a moment with a Charlie Hebdo caricature of the Prophet Muhammad. It's considered blasphemy to show an image of either God or of the prophets, just as a sort of tweak to Muslims who say, what do you mean we can't show the prophet? We will. And that, of course, led to the murder of some journalists at Charlie Hebdo. President Macron has come out quite bluntly and sharply against what he calls radical Islam. That has created, I think, a deeper rift. And very interestingly, we've seen the senior officials in the United Arab Emirates say Macron was right. We've seen President Erdogan of Turkey saying was wrong. It feels like these tensions between people who say there are no rules and people who say the rules must be defended to the death are escalating.
I found it a little curious when I saw the headline that a World War I ceremony was being held, true, by the French embassy, but in Saudi. World War I, did it impact Saudi Arabia?
The Ottomans were aligned with Germany in World War I, And the Ottoman Empire extended all the way down the coast, the Red Sea coast, to Yemen. So Jeddah, which really was the wealthy part of Saudi Arabia in the Hejaz, with all of the traders, all of the pilgrimage sites for Mecca and Medina, that was under Ottoman control. And Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, was working to help push the Ottomans out, which laid the ground for the Saud family from the northern plains of Saudi Arabia to control the Arabian Peninsula.
It is a fascinating history. John Alterman, the director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Hungary went into a 30-day coronavirus lockdown today, but just hours before curfew, Hungary's right-wing government proposed new legislation that has LGBTQ activists speaking out. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
A constitutional amendment sent to Hungary's parliament late on Tuesday would effectively ban adoption for same-sex couples in the country. And while the streets of Budapest are quiet due to the COVID-19 lockdown, the LGBTQ community is organizing online.
On social media and judging by calls and forums, we can really tell that the LGBTQI people are feeling very desperate and very anxious about the amendments.
Lucha Duditz is the communications officer at the Hatter Society, the largest and oldest LGBTQ rights organization in Hungary. People are nervous about the amendments because, if passed, only married couples could adopt. And same-sex marriage is illegal in Hungary. A small loophole in the proposal would allow single people to adopt if they're granted special permission from the Minister of Family Affairs.
However, this would still not mean anything for same-sex couples, as we are absolutely certain that they wouldn't actually grant exemptions for LGBTQI people.
According to Duditz, same-sex couples in Hungary who have already adopted children are not at risk at getting their kids taken away. Instead, this new law would affect the thousands of queer couples who hope to one day build a family through adoption. Another constitutional amendment proposed Tuesday would require children to be raised with what the government calls, quote, a Christian interpretation of gender roles.
I mean, I don't think you can really prepare for anything like this. We are not completely surprised, but it still came as a shock.
They're not completely surprised, Duditz says, because Hungary's far-right government has increased its anti-LGBTQ rhetoric throughout the pandemic. Back in May, during the country's first COVID-19 surge, Hungarian lawmakers overwhelmingly voted to end legal gender recognition for transgender people. Then, this fall, a children's book with trans and gay characters was called Homosexual Propaganda by Dora Duro, the deputy leader of the country's far-right party, Mi Hazánk.
Nem tűri a Mi Hazánk mozgalom, hogy a gyerekeket kitegyék a homoszexuális propagandának már azzal is, hogy
At a press conference, Duro walked away from her podium, ripped out the book's pages, and shredded them. Now, with protests and gatherings of more than 10 people banned across the country, the Hatter Society says the timing of the proposed adoption ban is also a strategy to distract the public.
We think that the goal is that people won't focus on the shortcomings of the government's crisis management of the pandemic, but the restrictive proposals that are concerning LGBTQI rights. I just can't imagine why they would rather focus on eroding people's rights instead of, you know, saving their citizens.
In a statement to the world, Hungary's Ministry of Justice says they're, quote, increasingly concerned about those modern set of ideas which call into question all traditional values, including the creation of the two sexes, which is a woman and a man, they specified. The statement continues to say that the new proposals are, quote, designed to protect the rights of children and future generations, as well as a child's right to receive education in accordance with Hungary's constitutional identity and Christian culture. Despite the outrage over the amendments, Lucha Duditz of the Hatter Society says people aren't likely to break lockdown rules to protest in the streets. Besides, she added, mobilizing in Hungary can be tough. Previous demonstrations haven't impacted political decisions. And the fate of the proposed ban on adoption for same-sex couples is all but certain.
I don't think there is a lot of chance for it to not go through.
That doesn't mean they won't try. Dudit says her organization will soon release plans to fight back against the proposal. If approved, the constitutional amendment would come into law in January of 2021. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump spent much of his 4 years in office trying to erase the signature achievements of the Obama White House. One of those top goals was undoing the Obama nuclear deal with Iran. President-elect Joe Biden vows to re-enter the deal. Iran's leaders say not so fast. They're indicating there may be a price to pay before they'll comply with the pact. Plus, new U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran this week may complicate a return to the deal even more. Ambassador Wendy Sherman was the lead negotiator on the deal. She was the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs for President Barack Obama. Ambassador Sherman, thank you for being with us again. How do you think a Biden administration will be able to turn back the clock on the Iran deal? I mean, it's not like there's a magic time machine that can take us back and pick up as if Trump didn't quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as it's known.
Yeah, indeed, Marco. We're not in 2016. We're in 2020 and almost to 2021. Time has passed. Circumstances have changed. And even though the deal was kept together by our European allies and by Russia and China, in the last year, I would say, it has started to unravel a bit. And although Iran has said it has taken reversible steps, nonetheless, we're not in the same place. So this will be difficult, hard work. And I would suspect that President-elect Biden and his team will first start by talking with our European allies, with France, Great Britain, Germany, with the European Union, and then with Russia and China to see what might be the best way forward.
And what about the view from leaders in Tehran? I mean, the suggestion that there might be a price to pay for the U.S. before they'd comply with any new pact. I mean, what is that price?
Well, one thing that I know about Iranian negotiators is that they are very tough. They're going to put as many chips on the table as possible before sitting down to talk with the new administration. That's how one negotiates. You try to create as much leverage as possible. So I'm sure that the president-elect will have a very capable and competent team to take a look at this. And one of the things that will be different, certainly, than the Trump administration is we actually will have diplomats in the State Department. We will have slots in the Pentagon filled that have not been filled with competent, capable people in our development agencies, in our intelligence community, and it will give us the wherewithal, the team that is necessary to do what will be a very difficult undertaking.
So speaking of sanctions, the Trump White House in its final weeks in office is vowing to slap new sanctions on Iran. In fact, some reports suggest there may be new sanctions on Iran every week until the 20th of January. I mean, that's going to make it a lot harder to revive the nuclear deal. And is that the point?
Well, I think that is indeed the point. I think that the Trump administration is trying to do whatever they can, quite frankly, to make it more difficult for the president-elect and vice president-elect when they come into office. But a lot of these sanctions are going to actually be similar to things that have already been done with new names on them. But the underlying sanctions, I think, are not fundamentally going to change. Sanctions have not brought Iran back to the negotiating table, nor have they stopped Iran's malign behavior in the Middle East. So a Biden-Harris administration is going to have to look at where we are. The president-elect has said he wants to re-enter negotiations and build back better. So this will be a very complicated puzzle, but one thing I know that will be different here is there will be a very capable and competent team that the president-elect is putting together. The transition teams that were announced just yesterday are 500 capable experts who know what they are about, because as the president-elect has said, this is not about the example of our power. Everybody is aware of our power. It's the power of our example.
So you spoke earlier about new faces coming into the Pentagon and State Department. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took aim at you and other potential new faces yesterday in an interview with Fox News. Here's what he had to say.
One of the things that I have observed now, almost 4 years into my time in this administration, is the previous folks just refused to get off the stage. So they talk about healing and all these transitional things. Frankly, I've watched Ben Rhodes, Susan Rice, and John Kerry and Wendy Sherman be active on the world stage in ways that weren't consistent with what the Trump administration is doing. I regret that it wasn't in America's best interest that they chose to behave that way.
Ambassador Sherman, Pompeo's point seems to be that officials from previous administrations should basically go home and not be pushing policies contradictory to this administration. What do you make of that?
I would say that I am always honored and privileged if I'm on a list with John Kerry, Susan Rice, and Ben Rhodes on any given day. That's an honor and a privilege. They are all patriots. They are all people who care about our national security. And every one of us who have been at, let's say, the Munich Security Conference or anywhere else where we are talking up to leaders around the world, we listen, we learn, we represent the interests of the United States of America. We understand there is only one president at a time. But part of a democracy is to be able to say what your point of view is, even if you disagree with the current administration. I don't think of that as getting on or off the stage. I think of that as democracy.
Ambassador Sherman, you served in the State Department during the Clinton and Obama administrations. Have you been speaking with the Biden transition team about how you might serve in his administration?
What I know is that the president-elect and the vice president-elect have a fantastic transition team. I'm now the director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and a professor of the practice of public leadership. And I encourage every single one of my students, if they have an opportunity for public leadership, to embrace it. There's no greater privilege than to help our country.
In the last 70-some days before the inauguration, what is keeping you up at night?
What is keeping me up at night, quite frankly, is that foreign leaders around the world who have called the president-elect to offer their congratulations seem to be respecting our democratic norms of transition more than the Trump administration, more than the Republicans in leadership positions. And I think it's quite critical that we move forward, because if we don't, we create a dangerous situation where adversaries around the world think they may have an opportunity to take on the United States, and that is not in our national security interest. So on a day that we honor our veterans, our military who believe in duty, honor, and country, I would hope that every American would do the same and honor the election that we've just had and move forward with the transition in the way we always have before the current circumstances, which are operating differently and, in my view, dangerously.
Ambassador Wendy Sherman served as the lead negotiator for the Iran nuclear agreement. She was the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President Barack Obama. Ambassador, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You rely on the world to bring you the global context. There's another way for us to connect when we're not in your ears. Start your mornings off with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. We'll send it to your inbox so you can begin the day informed. Get on the mailing list for our morning newsletter, Top of the World. You can sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Today in China, bust out your wallet. It's a massive retail sales day celebrated like a national holiday. It even has an anthem. Singles Day, a wave of consumerism like no other, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. In the days since Joe Biden won the U.S. election, President Donald Trump has been pushing a baseless claim that voter fraud robbed him of victory. That allegation doesn't square at all with many officials in the U.S., nor with what international election observers saw as they evaluated the U.S. election process. That includes observers with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. Katya Andrush is an OSCE election observer and a spokesperson for the OSCE's Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. She joins us from Warsaw. Katya, thank you for being here. First of all, can you explain what exactly international election observers do and what they were trying to achieve watching the U.S. election last week?
This is nothing new for us in so far as this is the ninth time that we've observed the U.S. elections. We've been observing in the U.S. since 2002. And we've been on the ground in the US since the end of September. And the other point to make now is that the election isn't over yet, which is why our observation is continuing. So we really take the long view. So election day is obviously necessary to any election. But to observe a democratic election process means to start way ahead of time to really look at that run-up to the election, election day, but then also the aftermath of the election, any complaints and appeals, which, of course, is the stage we're at now.
Right. So understanding that votes are still being counted and you're focusing on the present day, we are seeing President Trump pushing a claim with no evidence that the election was rife with voter fraud. But the OSCE's report concludes pretty much the opposite. What were your findings?
First of all, just let me say that every candidate has the right to go to court if they believe there have been any errors in the process. At the same time, to go back to what you were just saying, we have seen no evidence of systematic irregularities. Of course, there are errors made. The US is a huge country. The COVID pandemic has been a gigantic challenge for any country holding elections this year. But we have seen nothing systematic. And so this allegation of widespread deficiencies are groundless, according to our observation so far. The problem that we would see with this to a great extent that any comments to the contrary, any comments that that talk about systematic irregularities where there is no evidence of them, is the harm that can do to public trust in elections, in democratic institutions. And public confidence is absolutely crucial to the functioning of any democratic election process.
Taking a step back, Katya, based on what you saw during this election, did it change your long-term outlook for the health of U.S. democracy?
Often when we talk about election observation and with regard to this US election, it's quite easy to get into this very negative mode that everything is bad. And I would just like to make the point that things went amazingly smoothly for much of this election. Considering the challenges, considering the pandemic, this has been an absolutely huge challenge. The proportion of postal votes that were cast this time, that this has gone so smoothly, that people have been brought out to make use of their democratic right to vote. The fact that there was so much voter information has been really heartening. I've spoken to a number of citizen journalists who have been engaged in helping to ensure that voters knew how to vote, that sometimes this very complex process and complex ballot papers, for that matter, that people knew how to vote, where they needed to go, what they needed to do. It's actually been quite a heartening process in many ways as well.
Katya Andrush with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. She was an election observer during the U.S. presidential election last week and is a spokesperson for the OSCE's Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. Katya, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In Hong Kong today, 15 pro-democracy legislators resigned in protest. That came in response to Beijing's ongoing crackdown on dissent. The legislature has now passed a sweeping resolution barring anyone who supports Hong Kong independence or questions Beijing's authority from serving in the legislature. Wu Chi-wai is the chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party. He's one of the legislators who resigned today. Wu says he sees this moment as the end of the one country, two systems model for Hong Kong.
In the past, we believed that the basic law can be implemented in Hong Kong. But the changing of the attitude coming from the Beijing government, today they said basically the separation of power in Hong Kong is dead and all the check and balance in Hong Kong is no longer exists. And as a result, we will consider that is an end to the one country, two system.
So the way you and your colleagues resigned was very dramatic. You stood together, you and the pro-democracy legislators stood together, held hands and chanted, "Hong Kong, add oil, together we stand." What does that mean, add oil? Explain that.
Well, add oil, it means we cannot give up and we will stand firm to fight for democracy in Hong Kong, even though we are encountering huge obstacles putting up by the Beijing government. As we all have seen, there's a selective prosecutions and the police brutalities. And as a result, we hope and we urge all the Hong Kong people cannot give up, even though we are under huge pressures.
You have, and your colleagues have now resigned. Do you have a platform anymore? I mean, where do these resignations leave the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong now?
Well, as we all know that, we are encountering huge pressures coming from the mainland government and also the central government. And right now, we still have a huge platform in district council. But we have to expand and try to build up civic society so as to link up all the people that would contribute to the future democratic movement. Right at this moment, we have to acknowledge that it is a low time for the democratic movement in Hong Kong.
Does it mean that your kind of final platform for your movement is in the streets of Hong Kong?
Well, up to this moment, we have to link up every possible fight in every area. Because you know, even though we want to fight in the street, we'll be in trouble because of the national security laws. And there's a bar to public assembly of protests against the government. And so right now, we have difficulty because of the legal system. And because of the law enforcement situation in Hong Kong, that will not allow us to arrange huge, massive social movement in Hong Kong. So I can only say that we are now in a position that we need to find a new way to fight.
Do you expect the international community to help out or put pressure on Beijing?
I mean, the loss of the one country, two system also means the mainland government is not going to honor the international treaties. So we need international community to really pay attention to the changing situation in Hong Kong, and the whole substance of one country system that is stipulated in the basic law is completely changed by the Beijing government. So the situation is getting worse and worse. So I really hope that the international communities, on one hand, can put pressure to the Beijing government. On the other hand, can pay attention to the changing situation in Hong Kong.
Wu Chi-wai, speaking with us from Hong Kong. He's the chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party. He, along with other pro-democracy legislators, resigned today. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
You are welcome.
And now a very different story from China. If you're tuned into Chinese media last night, you would have seen this. Well, I've never heard this version of We Will Rock You, but our correspondent in Shanghai, Rebecca Canther, sure has. What are they singing there in Chinese, Rebecca?
Basically, what they're singing is Get Out Your Phones, It's Singles Day. And that was a song that was sung at the Double 11 or Singles Day television gala that was last night.
Singles Day television gala. Just what is Singles Day?
So it started a couple decades ago as kind of a fun activity for single college students. You know, 11-11 is just a bunch of ones. But Alibaba and Jack Ma, back in 2009, took it and manufactured a national holiday just for shopping. So I called up a college senior, Liu Jingyuan, and I asked, how do you celebrate Singles Day?
Many, many people staying up night till the midnight. One people will shop.
So she said she and her dorm mates, like many people around China, stayed up till midnight, filling up their online shopping carts and checking out just at midnight, just to get the best deals. And she said afterwards they compared their shopping carts and she went back for more.
Wow. So, I mean, I guess the spending happens all through 11-11. Do we know how much people spent at midnight?
Well, we know that already it's exceeded $56 million. And in just the first hour, $15 million was spent on home appliances, and there were 330,000 car orders made.
That's incredible. So,
yeah,
I know. Obviously, not everybody in China is taking part in this, I assume. Probably fairly affluent people, or is everybody kind of pulled into this?
If you use a smartphone, it's very hard to escape it because it's just sort of taken over social media.
So Alibaba is this huge online retailer, the ones that essentially created this holiday. Is it just for China or has Singles Day gone global?
It is starting to go global. There are people in Russia, the US, and other countries who are buying. And also, if you are a brand that wants to get into the China market, then this really is the way to do it. Nike launched their Air Jordan on Double 11 Day. Dior launched a new line just for Double 11. So lots of big brands, especially American brands, are using this festival as a way to capture eyeballs here. Mark Tanner is a consumer analyst, and he had this to say.
Alibaba has been actively recruiting a lot of American brands to come on board for the first time on Singles Day. This year, the U.S. is the number one for destinations outside of China shopping on Singles Day. Still a very small percentage, but it's increasing.
So like you said, after China, people in the U.S. are doing the most shopping on Singles Day.
So a gargantuan day of consumerism. I know among some critics of Singles Day in China, there's concern about waste. But I guess this is something you can't escape, as you say, even if you want to. Like, how did you celebrate Singles Day?
Well, I felt like I really needed to research this. So I did stay up till midnight. You know, you can't really escape it. So, of course, I had been thinking the past couple of days, well, what good deals could I find? To be honest, I didn't find very many good deals, but I did take advantage of this opportunity to buy a lot of toilet paper.
Wise move. The world's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai telling us about Singles Day, the shopping holiday in China and apparently reaching many parts of the world. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Italy, there's a ritual that some religious groups take part in. They bury aborted fetuses in cemeteries. Last month, outrage erupted after it was discovered at one of those cemeteries, crosses with the names of women who had an abortion. Lawyers and human rights groups have launched an investigation, citing privacy concerns. This incident has also renewed a conversation about a growing backlash against abortion rights in Italy. Lucia Benavides has that story.
In Italy, religious organizations have been burying aborted fetuses for decades. They do so legally. Fetuses 20 weeks or older are required to be buried, and an abortion at this stage is only allowed in cases of fetal malformation. If the woman doesn't claim the fetus in 24 hours, the hospital is responsible for arranging a burial. That's where religious groups like the Association to Defend Life with Maria come in.
Oh, Signore, che cos'è l'uomo? Perché te ne ricordi?
In a 2010 video posted to YouTube, the organization shows a typical funeral procession for what it calls unborn babies. Volunteers place dozens of fetuses inside biodegradable boxes, carry them to a cemetery in a hearse, and bury them in a mass grave. A Catholic priest blesses the fetuses and says a short prayer. In an email interview, spokesperson Stefano Di Battista said the organization is not responsible for the recent cemetery with women's names, but it does have an agreement with public hospitals to collect fetuses once a month, anonymously. Di Battista says the burials are a gesture of honor and piety. But retired gynecologist Silvana Agatone disagrees. She says groups like this one form part of a growing movement to stop abortion in Italy, though the practice has been legal since the 1970s.
There are no more gynecologists to provide abortion.
When she retired last year, Agatone was the only doctor providing abortions at her public hospital in Rome. That's because of a clause in Italy's 1978 abortion law that allows medical professionals, including nurses, obstetricians, and anesthesiologists, to avoid performing abortions based on moral or religious grounds. They call themselves conscientious objectors. According to Italy's health ministry, 68% of doctors are objectors, and that's had an impact outside medical rooms.
In many schools, doesn't exist the abortion service because all the teachers are objectors, no? So the students, they don't understand nothing about abortion.
Agatone says gynecologists willing to perform abortions are often overloaded with the work, since so few doctors are willing to do it, and the environment can be hostile, since most hospital heads are objectors. She says religious media in Italy are making it worse by spreading false information.
They're making so many publicities to the problems of the abortion. They are working with the fear, the sense of guilt. It's very easy, no?
Neil Data, secretary of the European Parliamentary Forum for Sexual and Reproductive Rights, says Italy is not an isolated case.
It's a globalized community of organizations and actors working towards the same aims.
Over the past decade, Data has been investigating a transnational network of ultra-right Christian organizations and powerful individuals lobbying against gender policies, including abortion rights and LGBTQ rights. They organize events like the World Congress of Families, attended by politicians, religious leaders, and aristocrats, where they strategize ways to maintain a conservative, Christian-centered vision of society.
Was more a response of the ultra-conservative movement to the social advances that had started in the mid-1990s. But what was an advance for human rights was felt as a defeat for another group of actors.
As opposed to pursuing a European-wide ban on abortion, Data says these groups focus on specific countries, using similar tactics in each. Their goal is to slowly chip away at abortion rights, he says, and hope for a domino effect. Data says these organizations often paint themselves as grassroots movements, when in reality they're financed by wealthy individuals. And this extends beyond Europe.
Organizations related to the U.S. Christian right are funding this movement.
He points to a report by the nonprofit Open Democracy that sheds light on dozens of U.S. groups, some with links to the Trump administration, funneling millions of dollars into conservative political campaigns in Europe. Data says U.S. conservative think tanks have also been successful in helping to get anti-abortion politicians elected and judges appointed, both in Europe and the U.S. In a written statement from one of these groups, Alliance Defending Freedom International, a spokesperson didn't confirm or deny the findings, but said Open Democracy is seeking to shut down debate and launch a smear campaign. Data rejects those claims and says it's important to build awareness about these organizations so that politicians and advocates can be alert to their tactics.
And so this is important because even though there's not something yet happening, they may have the people in the right place in the near future to do something. It's a long-term game.
In Europe, he says, right-wing anti-abortion organizing is still a relatively new phenomenon, but the impact is already being seen. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides.
A little over a month ago, Italy was a shining example for Europe. It had learned its lessons in the spring from the coronavirus pandemic. Italy dramatically brought down its infection rate and took up aggressive testing. Then, last month, cases started to soar again. Now the prime minister is introducing regional lockdowns across Italy, and that's led to protests in Milan, Naples, Rome, and other cities. So how did a country that seemed to have gotten it right suddenly got it so wrong? The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
When the coronavirus first hit the Lombardy region in northern Italy, the rest of Europe looked on in horror. There were news reports of churches filled wall to wall with coffins of the deceased. Medical staff compared it to a world war, and police cars patrolled the streets of cities like Naples, warning people over loudspeaker not to leave their homes.
Evitare gli assembramenti, evitare di andare nei luoghi affollati. Grazie.
But then within weeks, most of the rest of Europe was struck down too. When the second wave hit the continent at the end of summer, Italy appeared to be saved. The country had slowly come out of a long lockdown, and it looked like that caution might have paid off. In September, the World Health Organization posted a video praising Italian's strong and effective response to the pandemic.
Italy has been the first Western country to face this epidemic.
It was there, we had to react to it. And I think one thing that Italy didn't do, it didn't give up.
But not everyone was convinced Italy had things under control.
I thought that the pandemic wasn't finished, that the country was still very vulnerable. So a few months ago, I suggest the Italian government to take quick action.
This is Professor of Microbiology, Andrea Crisanti. Crisanti has become something of a celebrity in Italy for his repeated demands for increased testing. It was Crisanti who pushed for the entire population of the town of Vo to be tested. Vo was the location of Italy's first death from the virus. The results confirmed what Crisanti had long warned, that the coronavirus can spread through asymptomatic transmission. But when he wrote to national government in August saying he was worried about a second wave, Crisanti got no response.
Unfortunately, I wasn't taken seriously enough. I presented a plan, but they didn't answer. No.
Crisanti says the summer was the perfect opportunity for the Italian government to build an effective test and trace system. The country should be testing 400,000 people a day, he says. Instead, it's around half that. Crisanti says the government squandered time and money on other ventures. and he's not alone in his criticism.
The problem was that during the lockdown and after the lockdown, we did not evidently work with enough care to the preparations that were necessary to live with the virus for a little while.
Alberto Mingardi is with the libertarian think tank Instituto Bruno Leone in Milan. He says instead of spending money on healthcare, the government committed huge sums to nationalising businesses.
The government invested much of the political capital to start new endeavours, to envision what the Prime Minister Conte called a new strategy for government involvement in the economy. But somehow it prioritised this over the management of the pandemic here and now.
Mingardi says part of the problem is the ideological differences between the two parties in government, the Democratic Left and the populist Five Star Movement. He says both parties agree to an increase in spending, but disagreed strongly where that money should go. And it's not just the government that's divided. The country is split too, quite literally, into regions designated red, orange and yellow. Lombardy in northern Italy is once again in the red zone, meaning it's back under lockdown. But so too is Calabria in the south. Naples in the Campania region is designated yellow, meaning it must observe a curfew between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. and restaurants and bars can stay open but only until 6 p.m. The measures have sparked protests across the city, with protesters chanting liberty, liberty. Naples taxi driver Cirilo Mota thinks the government is using the regional restrictions to avoid paying out money to workers would otherwise be furloughed under a full lockdown.
I think it's a kind of fake news, because this is a way for the government to avoid to give the money to all those activities that should be closed with the orange or red conditions.
Lamotha says local restaurateurs are furious with the restrictions and are demanding the government provides evidence as to why they should close early.
You must tell me what means close at 6 o'clock the bar, and you can stay outside to drink a coffee, but you cannot go inside. This is what the owners of these activities say. Have you any study that show you effectively that inside the restaurant you can be affected by the virus?
With no tourists and few people on the streets after 6 p.m, Lamotha says taxi drivers in Naples are suffering. I ask him how much business he's lost since March.
Oh, this year, I think 95%, without a doubt, 95%.
In spite of his drop in income, Lamotha wants a full lockdown for 1 month to be imposed across the country. Microbiologist Andrea Crisanti is not certain this is the answer. A lockdown would curb the virus for a few weeks, he says, but then there'd be a third wave and then a fourth wave in the spring. Alberto Mingardi, with the libertarian think tank, doesn't believe a lockdown would work either.
One of the reasons why the lockdown worked, people were frightened and somehow they rallied around the flag. And alas, most of the stories people listen to these days are related to the inefficiencies of the system. And I think it's rather easy to predict that the lockdown will be far more difficult to enforce now than in the spring.
For months now, Italy's Prime Minister has vowed not to send the country back into a full national lockdown. But with the death rate rising and the number of infections soaring, Prime Minister Conte may find it hard to keep his promise. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Finally today, we close with a song of prayer, one that originated with the Yoruba people in what is now Nigeria, reinterpreted electronically today in Puerto Rico. The song comes courtesy of the band Ife from San Juan. The band has been feeling this year's losses and uncertainty, so they decided to turn to songs that honor the dead. Ife's founder, Otura Moon, says it's important to acknowledge and celebrate those who have passed before us. Power to all deceased. This is music for Egun Movement 2. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.